Okay. Good evening. Nope. Yeah. Okay. Hello. This is such a delight. All of American society around us is reaching levels of apocalyptic urgency, and here we are, tucked in a blanket of good beer and what is sure to be exquisite poetry, ready to share the evening with poet Robin Becker. I'm feeling lucky, y'all, and it's definitely not just the pre-read martinis. Anyone familiar with Robin Becker's work is also familiar with what it means to shimmy down the vine of identity. Becker writes about her experiences as a member of the Jewish faith and as a lesbian with insight and candor. Her poems are constantly revising her role as an American, as a lover, and as a human. Her ancestry often takes flight across the page and leaves us with only the weight of its wings. What draws us to Becker is her ability to achieve intimacy, often pulling us in with that dollop of a pronoun, we, while somehow simultaneously intoning impending loss in every other beat. As Becker says in one of her own poems, ostensibly about someone else, she makes you love your own loneliness. Robin Becker hails from Philadelphia and earned her bachelor's and master's from Boston College. She then went on to make her mark as a teacher at MIT until deciding to take her current position as liberal arts research professor emeritus of English and women's study at Penn State. In addition to her role as an educator and as a poet, Becker is a contributing editor to Plowshares and poetry editor for the Women's Book Review, Women's Review of Books, I'm sorry. She also writes a column called Field Notes for the Women's Review of Books. Becker's work has found its home in several renowned literary journals and magazines, including American Poetry Review, Prairie Schooner, Kenyon Review, and Georgia Review. She's published several collections of poetry, including The Horse Fair, My Favorite, All-American Girl, and most recently, Tiger Heron. She's also been the recipient of fellowships from the NEA, the Bunting Institute, and the Massachusetts Artists Foundation. But don't take their word for it. Let the struck gong inside your chest speak for itself, and welcome Robin Becker. Thank you.
Short people got no reason. Thanks, everybody, for coming, and thanks to Barbara and David and Aaron for inviting me to FSU, and to Keith for taking such good care of me during my visit here. Tonight, I'm going to read primarily from my new book, The Black Bear Inside Me, as well as a few other motley poems. As the title indicates, many poems in this book deal with the human relationship to animals. So I'm going to start with two poems that take up that theme. This poem is called Semblance. The dog I love is turning into my father, an old man I have to humor to get up, do his business. He even growls like my father and gives me the eye. I never know what kind of mood I'll find when he wakes from a nap and with stiff joints makes his way to the kitchen. When it rains, he turns from the door, whining. Peckish when it snows, he refuses to wear his coat. When people visit, he remembers his old manners and sometimes joins us on the couch and falls asleep snoring like my father, who never had much use for my conversation and showed his teeth when I displeased him, collared as he was and made to heal by his betters. After guests leave, he stares at his food. Sometimes I ignore him. Sometimes I plunge my hands into the smelly stuff and he eats from my palm. Like many teenage girls, I was a kind of horse-crazy teenage girl, and this poem comes out of my period of horse craziness. And it also takes up other issues that you'll see in the poem. It's called The Collection of the Canter. 3 days a week into that stable of pre-adolescence, I strode, where the smell of absorbine and hoof dressing rose astringent from the cross ties, where a girl in muddy boots circled a curry comb, where the language of bridles and bits rolled in my mouth as I said, D-ring snaffle and rubber pelham, Kimberwick and hackamore. And I learned a horse must come to the bit. You cannot force him to collect himself. You must ask him with your weight and legs and hands. The girl walked her horse into his stall, unbuckled the halter, and hugged the V where the breastplate left a sweaty place she scrubbed away. We grazed them on braided nylon ropes or leather lead shanks. Tornado, the open jumper, wore quilted leg wraps the daredevil Debbie knelt to secure. Summer Saturdays, we trailered them to shows, entered classes where I came to understand class as the father who rises at 5 to pack hoof pick and shedding blade. My father didn't see the point, came late, wore white loafers. I was the only Jew until Judy Cohen came with her black thoroughbred, her father the rabbi known to my family. Throat latch, cavesson, brow band, laced rein. I loved the bridle's vocabulary, the music of martingale and curb chain. Hanging in the tack room, where I came to understand class as Steuben saddles with brass nameplates. I never had the confidence, but I had a good ear. I never liked the nervous circling before the jumps or jumping, but I loved the words. Oxer, wing standards, jump cup. Women in show coats and proper fawn breeches, gloved hands steady at the withers, at the sitting trot, at the collected canter, over the jumps, and then the slow circle to mark a faultless round, applause, doff of the hat. She swung her leg over and casually slid off, reins in one hand, a Coke someone gave her in the other, glamorous even in the exercise paddock, counting off strides between the jumps. You never lose your early memory of class, tack room with gleaming bridles hanging in a figure eight conformation, where you waited, belonging with the others for your ride home. So on the subject of home, I'm going to turn to a poem from another book, which I'm especially happy to read here. This poem is called Old Florida. When the soon-to-be famous hurricane hurried to their neighborhood, I begged them to leave. Rain made a cassoulet of the parking lot. Winds juggled giant palms like rolling pins. Shy herons took cover beneath awnings and stood like museum guards in doorways. But my parents hunkered down. Children under desks in the 50s, the storm their personal blitz. I cried, I screamed over the phone, but they rejected the generator-backed shelter I found, chose canned goods and bunker until the phone died, and I consigned them to their neighbors, their luck, and their blood thinners. 87 years old, they hid out on the 9th floor, elevator out, infrastructure crumbling. But more than death or thirst, they feared their daughter with her talk of evacuation. Leaving home, even for natural disaster, made them refugees, registrants in a vast and subtly documented conspiracy to remove them from their apartment to assisted living. Neighbors found them sweating in their foxhole, ferried batteries, salami, and ice. And when the power came back, they phoned to report that hardship brought out the kindness in people. Wasn't it fortunate they stayed in their home? And where was my faith in human goodness? Another idea about home. This poem is called The Fix. Harvey says, it'll hold for now, meaning the gasket he's rigged to stop the leak in the water tank. It's what he says when he conjures a grasp of wood notched to catch a door that always swung shut. His supply of couplers and pipe makes visible the makeshift nature of our daily... His supply of couplers and pipe makes visible the makeshift nature of our daily operations. The contingencies he concocts from the hardware store of his truck to hold for now. Electrical and structural salvations he believes in the temporal, the neighborly, the seasoning, the salvaging of all reusable metal and wood, in the inevitable breakdowns coming towards us, about which he chuckles, installs a stop valve, and tightens the joint by hand, knowing a system undergoing a thermodynamic process can never completely return to its previous state. And a leaky valve in faucet or heart requires mechanical gods who say, wiping their hands, it'll hold for now. Sutured, duct taped now. Rubber banded now. Stretching elastic now. To reach at least next week. When my parents died, one of the things that I missed was the sound of Yiddish from my childhood, which was like the kind of background language to my history. My parents grew up in Yiddish-speaking households, and they, of course, learned English as kids, but they carried that Yiddish with them into adulthood. And when they wanted to talk about something that they didn't want my sister and me to understand, they spoke Yiddish. And they also spoke Yiddish between the two of them. And my friends who come from Spanish-speaking families said the same thing to me. Our parents spoke Spanish because they thought we didn't understand the Spanish. And of course, we understood when they were talking about us. So this poem comes from my thinking about missing that language. The sounds of Yiddish. The sounds of Yiddish splat like matzah, broken and dropped in the egg milk mix for matzah brei. They knock you deep in the kishkis. They smart Kinahura with the shtick of the canny mensch who knows schlock when she sees it. You think I'm a pisher? Don't drain your cup. Yiddish knows an example is not proof. Gives a tumbler with a pisk, the barbed shrug. When a schlamazel sells an umbrella, the sun comes out. You should grow like an onion with your head in the ground. Yiddish hisses with chicken schmaltz sizzling for knishes. Not invited to the luncheon? Don't worry, her knedlach don't float. Like the Sami with many words for snow, we have many for fool. Shtunk, schlepper, schlemiel, schmuck. Hear that rumbling across Ukraine? Yiddish ran from a posse of hazards when my bubby left her shtetl. Russians at her back and a mongrel middle-high German in her mouth. A language is a dialect with an army and a navy, the saying goes. To which my peasant relatives reply, spare us what we can learn to endure. I love that expression. A language is a dialect with an army and a navy. So you only become a language when you arm yourself. Isn't that an interesting concept? Otherwise, you're just a dialect. You're a language when you arm yourself. So let's see. Like many people, I have struggled to write poems that have some kind of political urgency and still feel to me like poetry. So a lot of the things I've tried to write feel more like rants, or they feel like they could be turned into a prose essay. And a lot of those poems I kind of, you know, put aside and think, you know, how will I know when I'm able to write a poem that has some kind of political weight and also really feels like a poem to me? So a few years ago, I was reading the New York Times, and I thought, this is some dumb assignment I might give my students, so why don't I just try it myself? So I came up with this assignment for myself, and I tried it, and this is the poem that came out of it. And I think you'll see what I tried to do. The poem is called Taken Into Account, and some of the italicized language comes from, it comes from an article called Sea Slaves, The Human Misery That Feeds Pets and Livestock, New York Times, July 27th, 2015. Taken into account. How to account for the lacerated hands of the enslaved 15-year-old Cambodian deckhands, whose infections come from the gills of the fish they sort and the nets they sew, 18 hours a day fishing in floating labor camps, the waters off Thailand, to supply the Songla Canning Public Company of Thailand. And how to account for the bribes of the desperate trafficker whose own sons roam in rags the streets of Bangkok traffic, whose promises to guide the migrant boys to decent jobs disappear inside the shipping crate, where boys stashed for days are disappeared. Quote, to get tangled in the mesh and yanked underwater, it is likely that no one would notice right away. The work is frenzied and loud as the boys chant in unison while pulling the nets. And how does one account for the captain who must net more and more kidnapped migrants as some jump overboard or die from beatings or try to escape to other ships rather than die in darkness, casting at night a seine net barefoot on the slick deck? And what of unmoored winches and tackle sliding across the deck to fracture a femur or rip into a thin thigh? On the South China Sea, you belong to the captain. No laws protect you when no one can see. So what I did was try and use couplets in which I used the same word at the end of each couplet. Hands, hands, fish, fishing, Thailand, Thailand, traffic, trafficker. So that was the assignment I kind of set myself for that poem. And this poem may be coming to a theater near you, or it might already have come to a theater near you if you've been teaching long enough. This comes from teaching at a university. And this is an experience I've had more than once, and probably, I wonder if Aaron and David and Barbara have had this experience. It's called security clearance. The tall one wore a gray raincoat, and the short one in a beige raincoat said, "They knew he'd been my student. They wouldn't take much of my time. It was a government matter." They sat in the chairs where my students sit for conferences and took out their notebooks like students, and then one asked, "Does he have any reason to do harm to America?" Once Daniel brought to seminar a poem about Mount Nam Sin and the Han River set in Korea, where he'd gone over Christmas break to see his mother, a lieutenant stationed in Yongsan. I urged him to think about grad school, but he wanted Army intelligence. What did he like to do in his spare time? "He wrote poetry," I said. "He wrote poetry," the short one repeated, and the tall one wrote it down, repeating, "Poetry." "How would you characterize his temperament? Mild," one coached, "easily riled." The smart girl with spiky purple hair liked to sit beside him. The only black student in the class, he never spoke about race when race surfaced in seminar. "Use of drugs or alcohol?" I called on him when we talked about craft. "Daniel," I asked, "what do you hear in the music of these lines?" He studied all weekend, an honor student, a double major. He often put his head down on the desk, resting as the others drifted in, as if he needed to conserve his energy. On the incarceration of black men in our country, on the presidency of Barack Obama, we never spoke. "Would he have any reason to be angry at the United States?" We looked at his line turns. We talked about syntax and diction. He read Keats and Kamunaka, loved choosing odd verbs and offbeat images. He knew indirection sometimes works best, shifting pace and tone. "What can you say that would help us evaluate Daniel's suitability for sensitive work?" The last time I saw him, he said he'd gotten some sleep and was moving to D.C. to await his security clearance. "You could get a fellowship to grad school." I repeated, "You wouldn't have to pay." "You always pay," he said, and shook my hand. "Thank you for your time," the tall one said. "Is there anything you would like to add about Daniel's character or work ethic?" Once he brought to class a poem in which the speaker takes a gun apart and reassembles it after cleaning. I figured his mother taught him how to do it. The poem showed such a loving attention to detail. That ever happened to you guys? Online. Never. They never showed up at your door. I hope they never do. It's a creepy experience. The Wages of Sin. New neighbors down the road posted a sign that reads, "The wages of sin is death. None come to the Father but by me." Atrocity alters how language comes to us. Orlando, American shorthand for tragedy no magic kingdom will undo. Newtown, Columbine. The semi-automatic slaughters light names with a detonating charge. He who worked for Disney's wages will return neither to his father nor to anyone. How to love my neighbor as myself, then? I can't. Gay kids who went to dance at Pulse pay with their lives, while down the road, the sign. God's gift to us, eternal life through Christ. I was a fellow at the Bunting Institute at Harvard, and afterwards I forever received the Radcliffe Quarterly, which is one of the things they do to you after you leave an institution. You are forever dogged with all of their magazines from one institution or the next. Anyway, one of the things I used to enjoy doing was reading the obituaries in this thing. And one year I was reading something and I was just stunned that there was an obituary for a bird. So I wrote this poem. It's called Alex, an Obituary. A-L-E-X. His name stood for Avian Learning Experiment. She bought him in a pet shop. He learned to identify 6 shapes and 5 colors. Correcting Griffin, the younger bird, he would shout, 6, not 4. He had to endure hundreds of repetitions to achieve statistical importance. He would say, want to go back? And she would say, have a nut. He would say, want a banana, want a carrot? And she would say, you're just interrupting our work. At 30, he had the emotional life of a 2-year-old human child. Each night, when she put him back in his cage, he said, I love you, see you tomorrow. So this, have you heard about this bird, Alex, the great gray parrot? Well, if you want to read an amazing story about human-animal connection, this woman found this parrot in a pet shop. The parrot and she were work partners for something like 31 years. And then the parrot eventually died. But they revolutionized the idea of avian ability to communicate. And let me see if I can, I'll tell you her name so you can look her up. Here it is. Animal psychologist Irene Pepperberg conducted a 30-year experiment with Alex, 1976 to 2007, an African gray parrot, as her research partner. Their work focused on reasoning skills and language acquisition. She also was refused funding by almost every funding agency for 30 years. So that's interesting to know. Good point, David. I don't think she worked on Yiddish with him, but that might have been more fun. This poem is called Men as Friends. I have a few, which is news to me. Tom drops by in the mornings with his travel mug. My mother would call it a coffee klatch. We review our terrible histories with fathers and talk about the father he's become and how much it will cost to replace the gutters the ice brought down. And then there's soft-spoken Harvey. You just heard about him in the fix, Harvey, who's fixing everything. And then there's soft-spoken Harvey, with whom I enjoy long pauses in conversation about how they raised the Nelson Town Hall and put a foundation underneath, during which we both look up at Mount Monadnock and then down at the ground and then back at each other, silence precipitating the pretty weather we share before Harvey goes inside for lunch. When I had to pack up my office, Tom boxed and loaded books into my car. I didn't think he'd want to, but his idea of friendship includes carrying heavy things. At the dog park, The Marine with the schnauzer asked, "Do you have a husband?" I replied, "I don't care for men in that way." As a Marine, James mostly played cards on a supply ship. Now he mostly hunts and fishes, climbs his orchard ladder for my Cortlands, and in trout season, leaves in my fridge two rainbows. I'm going to read one poem, and it has a cute story. I started sending poems to the New Yorker in 1977, and I would send poems to the New Yorker every year. The 70s came and went. So did the 80s. Then it was the 90s, and I was convinced this was really going to be my decade to get a poem into the New Yorker. And then the 90s came and went. And so finally, in 2016, I had a poem accepted by the New Yorker. Thank you. And it was one of the shortest poems I'd ever written. So it took up the smallest amount of space you could ever imagine in the New Yorker. In fact, most of my friends never saw it when I said, "Did you see my poem?" They said, "No, where was it? It must have been so small, we completely missed it." Anyway, here it is. It's called Theory. As the animal returns on a beaten path to the den, we go back over the facts. Certain we ignored clear signs. I left for Italy that summer, though she had quit her job and moved back home. I knew it signaled a bad turn, but chose the Tuscan love affair in the 17th century olive mill. We say we survive our siblings' suicides, meaning we stood with our parents at the unthinkable graves. In one theory, the troubled family sacrifices one member as plants surrender leaves in times of drought. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.